Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Joining me today is Stannis Smith, who's a Burnaby resident, who is not happy with the new flight routes proposed by NAV Canada, the national agency that manages Canadian airspace. The new routes will bring more planes over North Burnaby neighbourhoods. Thanks for joining me today, Stannis.
My pleasure.
You have started a petition that calls for NAV Canada to reconsider these changes. What are some of your concerns?
Well, I have a number of concerns. For people who are not aware of this proposal, it was announced late last year that NAV Canada is going to be consolidating all of the air traffic in the Greater Vancouver region. And what that means is that they're taking the air traffic, which right now is quite dispersed, and they're channeling it into what I would call freeways in the air. And they have said on their in their public announcements that these changes are being made in the name of enhancement of safety, modernizing procedures, and demand, and those may well be the case. However, there is very significant impact to a number of residential areas, and I would add to SFU, because one of the main freeways will go pretty well directly over SFU at a very low altitude.
Yeah, I've seen that route. It comes right over the campus.
Exactly. And my concerns are several. The first is that in the information that NAV Canada has made public, they're using outdated standards for noise contours. And without getting too much into the technical details, they are using noise thresholds that have been superseded many years ago by the World Health Organization and a number of other entities. So in simple terms, the noise levels that they consider to be acceptable are double or more than double what the World Health Organization and others recommend. NAV Canada has also not proposed any mitigation measures, or certainly they haven't disclosed any that they've made public or spoken about alternatives such as different routes, such as moving capacity to Abbotsford rather than YVR, such as curfews at night, which many cities have. So there's no consideration of ways in which these new routes would potentially cause less impact. And my final major reservation is that there's a lack of due process and transparency. The way these have been put out to the public is that these are the routes that NAV Canada has decided upon, and we are invited to comment on them. However, there's been no due process about how they even came up with them in the first place.
Right. So you're talking about a lot of technical aspects of this, but you're not just a resident of Burnaby who might be affected by this. You do have some expertise in this area. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Well, yes, I've been involved in airport design for most of my professional career. I'm currently working on projects in the States, and so I bring that perspective. And there is a certain irony to me taking this position, and obviously I have a vested interest. I'm in one of the areas that will be affected. But I think increasingly people are realizing that noise pollution is a major consideration. It's a major health consideration. And to the extent that these routes are going to impact real people on the ground who live in residential areas, I think that the potential impacts are very serious, not to mention, of course, the potential economic impacts to people who are now going to be living in areas that will probably see some depreciated value as a result of being in a flight path.
Right. So you mentioned a bit about sort of the process, and as you describe it, NAV Canada sort of makes the decision, and then there's an invitation for some comments. But what's the process after that? I mean, what do the comments mean?
Well, it's a great question. And obviously, to the extent that NAV Canada is going to take those comments into consideration, I think you would need to ask them. However, NAV Canada is an independent entity. It's not answerable directly to the public. It's only answerable to Transport Canada. Transport Canada sets the regulatory authority. And so our petition is a very simple and I think very reasonable request for an independent environmental assessment of these potential routes. And if this project was anything other than an airspace, if it was, let us say, a new freeway going through a residential area, or if it was a new major infrastructure project, it would automatically trigger an environmental assessment before the new routes were actually designed. So I think that our request, which is it's a Government of Canada petition, we already have the prerequisite number of signatures on it. It's a request to Transport Canada to exercise their authority and undertake an independent environmental assessment with emphasis on the independence, because all of the materials that NAV Canada has produced so far have been internally generated or generated by consultants hired by NAV Canada.
So what is the threshold for the petition, and how many have you got so far?
The threshold's 500. We have we're getting close to 900.
Yes.
So, and we'd love to get more, because obviously the more people that see this as being a concern, the more likely it is that Transport Canada will pay attention. And I think that certainly from the point of view of SFU, anybody taking a look at those maps has every reason for serious concern. Mm-hmm. The aircraft will be lower than 5,000 feet as they go over SFU. And I'm not sure what altitude SFU is at. It's at several hundred feet at any rate. So
it's at like 1,300 feet.
Right. So this is going to be a very significant noise issue directly over SFU, not just, of course, for the tuition spaces, but for people who are living on the hill.
Mm-hmm. So what do you say to people who say, well, the planes have to fly somewhere? Why not over North Burnaby?
What I say is, firstly, the same, you know, let's think about Vancouver in the 1950s, when people proposed to take all of the dispersed traffic and put it into freeways. And citizens of Vancouver said, no, we're not interested in that. And I think as a result, Vancouver is a more livable city. Well, I think we'd all agree that when you look at other cities who chose the freeway route. And this is a direct analogy. I mean, what we're talking about here are freeways in the sky. NAV Canada in their materials have said that 61,000 homes will be, or 61 fewer homes will be impacted. And I would say that at the minimum, that is highly misleading, because the criteria they're using are outdated criteria. I think if they were to use current thresholds of noise that are accepted by respected entities such as the World Health Organization, they would find that that the impacts are very significant. So that's what I would say to people. The other thing I would say is that many cities our size have more than one airport. You can think of many airports, many cities that have two airports. And there is another perfectly viable airport out there in Abbotsford. And the irony of this whole situation is that the residents of Tri-Cities, Burnaby, New West are going to be paying the price for enhancements to YVR, when in fact their closest airport is Abbotsford.
Right.
So there really is an irony there from my perspective.
So if I understand what you're saying, I mean, these changes aren't just moving the routes, but they're concentrating. So the areas that are affected will be seeing perhaps more flights than any particular area under paths now. Is that correct?
Exactly.
All right. So is there any established appeal process for these kind of changes other than what you're doing right now with the petition?
The only appeal process that I am aware of is to appeal directly to NAV Canada, which I and a number of people have done.
Yep.
And to appeal to Transport Canada to exercise its authority to undertake an independent environmental assessment. And Transport Canada has that authority.
All right. And have you heard of any other communities being successful in this kind of appeal?
Well, this is the first time that the airspace in Canada is being materially changed in many decades.
Right.
So this is an unprecedented situation.
Interesting. Well, how do people find out more about your petition and the issue, and where can they go and join the petition if they're interested?
I'd encourage everybody to take a look at the website that we've launched. It's nooverflights.com. That's nooverflights.com. And on that website, you'll see a lot of materials and obviously the link to the petition. And we really would encourage people, if they are concerned, to sign the petition and help us to hopefully move this in a direction that's going to be better for all concerned.
Well, thank you for joining me today, Stanis. Stanis R. Smith is a Burnaby resident and architect who's worked on airport design around the world or around North America. Thank you for joining me today.
Okay, thank you for your interest.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Western Front will be hosting the Touk Craft Fair from December 1st to 3rd. It will showcase a curated selection of BC-based artists, craftspeople, and designers who make textiles, ceramics, jewelry, accessories, stationery, and home and body products. The event is all about coming together, meeting artists, and connecting with what is being made in our community. If you are interested in participating as a vendor, make sure to submit the application form by August 31st. To access the application form and for more details of this event, visit toukcraftfair.com.
This is Bird Note. Before the high-tech gadgets used to track bird migration today, a Louisiana ornithologist studied migration with one simple tool: a telescope aimed at the moon. George Lowry dreamed up moonwatching in the 1940s to prove that birds regularly migrated across the Gulf of Mexico. He knew you could see the silhouettes of migrating birds passing in front of the full moon through a telescope. Working with an astronomer, Lowry turned moonwatching counts into standardized measurements to compare the amount of migration at different places and times. On a ship docked on the coast of Yucatan, Lowry pointed his telescope out over the Gulf. He calculated that 3,700 birds crossed an imaginary one-mile line on the water every hour. Then, in the 1950s, he organized the first continent-wide survey of migration patterns with thousands of volunteers across North America. Moonwatching became obsolete once scientists began using radar to monitor migration. But you can still point a telescope at the moon and see those flickering silhouettes of birds on the move. Learn more about the history of bird migration research in Rebecca Heisman's new book, Flight Paths: How a Passionate and Quirky Group of Pioneering Scientists Solved the Mystery of Bird Migration. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
The Bill Reid Gallery presents Bright Futures, an exhibition that brings together the innovative art of Bill Reid with new works by contemporary emerging and established Indigenous artists of the Northwest Coast until January 14th, 2024. To celebrate the life of Bill Reid 25 years after his death, contributing artists were invited to ponder and critique the question, how is Bill Reid continuously inspiring contemporary Northwest Coast artists? To learn more about this exhibition, visit billreidgallery.ca.
Hi, first of all, and who are you and why are we here today?
Thank you, and hi. My name's Angie Brooks Wilson. I'm the new Dean of Science here at SFU, and I've been in the role just over a month. This is following, our discussion here is following the ceremony to honor the women killed at the École Polytechnique on December 6, 1989, and to talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion in STEM.
And you were talking about gender-based violence is connected with racism as well. Why is it connected and how is it connected?
I should say that I'm not actually an expert in this particular field, which I think would be more sociology. So my answers are more the you know, based on the life experience of one person rather than being correct in a social science sense. But I think that I tend to view discrimination against one group as connected to discrimination against another group, perhaps relating to people who feel the need to discriminate because they want to feel superior to someone.
And you talked about how women in the field of scientists are treated right now. And do you see a development right now in Canada in the field of science?
I do see changes. I have seen changes in how people behave towards women in scientific workplace over the course of my own career. It used to be more that certain ways of joking around that could make women feel not included were commonplace in the workplace. And now I don't hear very much of that at all anymore. So I do think that things are changing in terms of how people behave in the workplace. And I also think that things are changing in terms of processes that we use to try to ensure equity, diversity, and inclusion in places like SFU. So for example, when a hiring is done for a professor position, we have formal ways of looking at the applicant pool and making sure that, for example, the short list should reflect the diversity of the long list and should not be moving towards just a subset of that list.
And where do you still see room for improvement, or what can people still do better right now in Canada or all around the world? Because there's still problems, right, or things that can be better? Or what do you think about that?
It's a hard question to answer. There definitely are things that people need to do. I think so much of the issue lies within each person. How do you re-educate a person who maybe was brought up to think that certain groups are not their equal to understand that they really are? I don't know how to overcome that problem. But I think that in workplaces like at SFU, where they're very organized, we have systems and a very clear intent to move toward equity, diversity, and inclusion, I think that people in workplaces like ours can become familiar with those processes and work in an environment that really is aspiring to EDI and become, I hope, more enlightened by doing that.
And do you think women in science or in a male-dominated work field are still underestimated, or are they more appreciated now? Because the work and their work, is this more appreciated than when you began to study, for example?
I think appreciated might be too strong a word. I think that being accepted and treated as equals, I think we are slowly moving in the right direction. But we're not there yet. I think we'll be there when the numbers are equal in the various areas.
You talked about you were in SFU here for 1 month, right?
I've been in the role of dean for just over a month, and I've been at SFU since 2008.
Wow.
In various ways.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. And you talked about plans for the future. You're comfortable to share this with us as well? Like you talked about you don't have an exact plan, but you talked about plans in general or ideas for the future. You want to share this with us?
I can share a little bit of it. So I'm very big on making plans with the faculty. I have a lot of ideas for all aspects of how we run the faculty, but I want to also welcome ideas from the grassroots, from all of our professors, our grad students, and so on. And we will have a formal process of strategic planning to do that. And I'll knit together my ideas with the ideas of our professors and students to arrive at a good plan and specific goals. For the goal of increasing equity, diversity, and inclusion in the Faculty of Science, we have one action that is upcoming. The previous dean, Dr. Paul Kench, started a position called the Associate Dean for EDI. And that position was occupied by Dr. Mary Catherine Kropinski for a couple of years. And Mary Catherine moved up to a position of special advisor to the Vice President, People, Equity, and Inclusion. And so the role has been vacant for a few months. So I have discussed with the department chairs that we will be reactivating that role, and very soon we will be calling for faculty members within our faculty to apply for that associate dean position. Once that person is selected, they will be the lead person for initiatives to increase EDI in the Faculty of Science. And so they will lead an EDI committee. They will be able to help organize ideas to improve EDI. They will probably look at all our processes to ensure that they are robust in terms of considering all groups equally. And so that will actually be a very important position. And so I will work with and provide ideas to that person.
Nice. That sounds very good. Good plan
Thank
for
you.
The future. Mm-hmm. You also shared your own story at your speech here at SFU. And there also, do you have any tips for girls who are struggling with gender-based violence in the field of science? Do you have any tips for those who are struggling with it still? So because you shared your own story and you talked about that you were not had not the courage to speak up against the men, but because the men had no power over you, it didn't change anything for you. But what do you have a tip for a girl who is still struggling with a man that has power over her?
Oh, that's a really difficult question, because if you're referring to women in other countries where they're working under a regime where women are not considered equal, my life experience doesn't give me much to advise them. So I think that's a very tough issue, and I just wish them the best in their you know, fight for equality. For female STEM students here in Canada, I think that my advice would just be stick to your goals and try not to be deterred by bad attitudes by some other people. Most other people are good and supportive, and it's a few bad apples out there that would try to deter female students. But I would just say stick to your goals and perhaps seek mentorship from a female faculty member, or band together with other female students and share your experiences so that you have a support group with each other. And yeah, just stick to your goals.
And do you have any last words for us, or any statement or a tip or something else?
No, I would just say thank you for using your radio station to raise awareness of this really important issue. As we heard in the event today, one of the young women who spoke said that she hadn't realized that there was discrimination against women in STEM until she saw it herself. And so just knowing that it's there and being ready and being aware of the issue, it's good of you to raise awareness. Thank you
so much. And you can rehear the interview on cjsf.ca. And thank you so much for this interview.
Let it all die. choir singing, yeah, you try. And baby, that's life. Baby, that's life.
One of the most important things I've learned about ticks is that they can be found in many different habitats, including forests, city parks, and school grounds. When it comes to avoiding ticks, awareness and prevention are the first line of defense for adults, children, and animals. Dr. Becky Trout-Frixel is a medical and veterinary entomologist, researcher, and associate professor at the University of Tennessee. She specializes in vector control, surveillance, ecology, and genetics. We reached her in Knoxville, Tennessee. Welcome to our podcast, Dr. Becky.
Thank you for having me.
How did you become interested in veterinary entomology and pathogen surveillance?
You know, it started off when I was at the University of Kentucky as an undergraduate and a graduate student. There were some little tiny caterpillars called Eastern tent caterpillars that were causing mare reproductive loss syndrome with horses. And basically a bunch of these horses and foals were aborting and dying. And I was just fascinated with the idea that something so small could take out something so big. And so from there, I've really been looking at mosquitoes, ticks and flies, all of these things that are affecting humans and animals and trying to help protect them.
Wow. And so maybe we can just tell our audience a bit more about that. What is a vector?
So a vector, so we can think of vector in many different ways. When I teach it in the classroom, I always ask my math students, you know, what a vector is. And we think of it as that angle that moves something from A to B. And that's really what it is. So it's an arthropod that bridges spatially and temporally a pathogen from point A to point B. And so in my world, it's a mosquito, a tick, or a fly.
And so let's talk a little bit more about ticks and what makes them unique and how they attach to hosts. What is a hypostome?
Okay, so the hypostome is the mouth part of a tick. It's barbed, kind of similar to a bee's stinger is barbed so that it can't come out. But the hypostome is the part of the tick that actually attaches to you and creates a little cement layer to actually glue itself to you and allows for that blood feeding to occur between the individual, the host, and the tick.
And what are festoons and how are they used to identify different tick species?
So festoons are on the kind of like the posterior end of the tick. I like to think of them as like the little buttons or the jewels on ticks. So, you know, festoons on military uniforms and more.